welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gather to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, the co-founder and executive director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Nihad Awad. His talk entitled "The Rise of Islamophobia and Its Impact on National Security" was recorded at a meeting of the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on Friday, October 15th.
Welcome, I'm Lisa Falsko. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and I'd like to welcome you today for an exciting program. Now I'd like to introduce our head table. We have right to my immediate left, Mr. Nihad Awad, and to his left we have Laura Cameron, who along with Oksana is a scholarship winner to our national conference in Washington, D.C. So congratulations on that. And to her left is Mr. Bob Iden. And if you'd like to do the introduction.
It's my pleasure today to introduce Nihad Awad. Mr. Awad is the executive director and co-founder of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. CARE is the largest nonprofit Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization in the United States. Numerous law enforcement agencies and Fortune 500 companies, including Nike and DKNY, have benefited from CARE educational seminars on Islamic traditions and culture. In addition to resolving employment discrimination issues involving American Muslims, Mr. Awad has also conducted over 100 public relations and media training seminars nationwide. Mr. Awad has met with former Secretaries of State Madeleine Albright and Colin Powell to discuss the needs of the American Muslim community. He is a regular participant in the U.S. Department of State's International Visitors Program, which welcomes foreign dignitaries, journalists, and academics who are currently visiting the President of the United States. Mr. Awad has testified before both houses of the U.S. Congress, most recently as Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on matters of involving Muslims in America. He has spoken at prestigious educational institutions including Harvard, Stanford, and Johns Hopkins University. He was a featured speaker at the 2002 Reuters Forum on Global Cooperation at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. In addition, he actively works with local and national interfaith leaders and organizations in the interest of promoting positive relations among people of diverse faith communities. He has been frequently interviewed on national and international media such as CNN, BBC World Service, PBS, NPR, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. He's here today to speak to us on the rise of Islamophobia and its impact on national security. Please join me in welcoming Nihad Awad.
Thank you, Laura. Good afternoon. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be with you. First of all, I'd like to let you know that this is my first visit to Anchorage, first visit to Alaska. And since I was a teenager, I saw Alaska on a small TV screen from the refugee camp I was born and raised in, thousands of miles away. I never dreamt that I will even leave that camp in my life, let alone travel to Europe where I received my first education, or come to the United States and eventually be at Alaska, in Alaska, and enjoy the cold weather. Sam, who has been insisting on inviting me to come for the past year, when he called me like a couple of days ago, he said, "I have news for you." I said, "What?" He said, "It's 35 degrees. And I said, "Well, that's not bad news because I used to live in Minnesota." Anyway, when I broke the news to my family that I'm coming to Alaska, there was almost a revolt because they wanted to be with me. So I promised them next year we'll be here in June when the weather is much nicer. But I also have to tell you about stereotypes about Alaska. stereotypes that have been there for decades in my mind and stereotypes that have been in my mind for maybe the past 2 years. Decades, Alaska looked to me white, not like the white people, but the snow. Far, distant, very cold, and hardly any people live there. In fact, when I was looking at the Wikipedia of Alaska, I found out that there is one person per square inch. There is one person per square mile in Alaska. Of course, that would be too small. Where I lived in the refugee camp, there were about like 40,000, and no exaggeration, 40,000 per square mile. So you're lucky to have a lot of space, not very tall buildings, and a lot of opportunities to grow. Another stereotype about Alaska is Alaska made the news in the past 2 years about Sarah Palin and her strength of vision to see Russia from here. And so if you're left only with those stereotypes about Alaska and not having the chance to come and see people, interact, and enjoy the good weather, you will be left with inaccurate perception of Alaska and its people. Anyway, I have been very fortunate to come and spend a few hours also to discover the size of the American Muslim community here. I'm happy to see that there's a vibrant community that's engaged, interactive, and they're very, very proud of, being here in Alaska. In fact, last night I saw probably the most senior member of the Muslim community, Mr. Obeidi, Sam's father, who's been here, I believe, since 1956. I'm very happy to see that the Muslim community feels at home in Alaska and in Anchorage. Ladies and gentlemen, the issue at hand, Islamophobia, the rise of Islamophobia and its impact on national security, is an important subject. But before examining the impact of Islamophobia on national security, we have to define what is Islamophobia. Is criticizing Islam Islamophobia? Is criticizing Muslims Islamophobia? I know you asked me to look that way, so I'm looking there. No. Criticism of Islam is not Islamophobia. And if you are critical of Islam and Muslims, you're not an Islamophobe. In fact, I myself am very critical of many Muslims, but I'm very proud of my faith. So having free discussion and debate to discuss the faith, politics, is healthy. In fact, it's needed. I believe that people fear what they don't know. And Islam is the most unknown, misunderstood religion in the United States today. If you look at the history of Islam in the United States, you will be surprised that Islam preceded Columbus. When you study the history of Islam in the United States, you will see that about 30% of the slaves who were brought from West Africa were Muslim. But Islam disappeared for centuries because of the forced conversion from Islam to Christianity by the white people. And Islam reappeared in America in the form of the Nation of Islam, which many, if not the majority of Muslim Americans, disagree with that version of faith, because racism in Islam is prohibited, regardless of who's discriminating against whom. But in the past maybe 60 years, the United States opened the doors for immigration, and many people came to the United States, whether as workers, skilled workers, or students. And today we have about 8 million Muslims in the United States with over 2,000 mosques. People came to the United States because they believe in the values of freedom, They believe in progress. They believe in the opportunities. And that's why the Muslim community in the United States in what is one of the most thriving Muslim minorities outside the Muslim world. They love America. They believe this is their home, and they believe this is their future. So what is Islamophobia? Islamophobia is the irrational fear and prejudice against Islam and Muslims. In the past few weeks, months, and years, Islamophobia has become an industry. I call it the industry of fear. People thrive and profit from spreading misinformation about Islam, from exploiting legitimate fear and lack of knowledge about Islam. With the sophistication of the media, the internet, Islamophobia starts on the internet. It goes unchallenged, unchecked. It makes its ways to mainstream television and opportunists who come on local or national media outlets. They take advantage and they exploit the absence of American Muslims' engagement and appearance on these networks. And they found it unchallenged area where they can just spread any rumors, make any interpretation. And unfortunately, they have succeeded in many ways. And I'll give you some examples later on. But also, people who promote Islamophobia in the United States are the same people who promoted phobia against other minorities in the history of this nation. The same phobia that was promoted against Catholics, against Jews, against blacks, against Latino Americans, even against Native Americans, Eskimos, Indian Americans, and so on. It's a very comfortable way to see and project the other minorities as the other, and try to justify either their elimination, their persecution, or their discrimination against them. When you look at, for example, Park 51, and I will discuss it further, you may see that there was, all of a sudden, local, national, and international debate on Park 51. All of a sudden, it became an issue of sensitivity, an issue of religious freedom, an issue of national security. So many people, all of a sudden, exploited this issue. Why? I believe because there is a lot of ignorance about the issue itself. And let me just, before I leave Park 51 issue, a few days ago in the New York Times, there was a story about the oldest church in Lower Manhattan, New York. They're about to celebrate the 225th anniversary of that church. When they were preparing, they were looking at the history of the church, and they found out the same argument, the same exact argument was made against Park 51. Foreign funding and linking that church to a tyrannical teaching. And they opposed the creation of that church, and over time, the church was built, thrived, and now they're celebrating 225 years. And the priest and his colleagues were saying, when we were looking at the debate over Park 51, two blocks from ground zero, so equidistant from ground zero, one to one side and the other to the other side. So they say the same argument was raised against those who were building a church there. Park 51, unfortunately, is the tip of the iceberg. Some people think Muslims are insensitive to the memories of the families of 9/11 and the victims. And I think there is legitimate fear because there is misunderstanding. And the Muslim community, Muslim Americans, should try to undo that misunderstanding But I think that national debate was hijacked by the very small minority in our society who tried to project American Muslims as the others, who tried to tell America and the world that Islam attacked us. They did not say 19 foreign nationals came and attacked all Americans, Jews, Christians, Muslims, and everyone who were there. They did not tell the story that among the victims also were Muslim Americans. They did not tell the story that among the first responders also were Muslim Americans. They risked their lives and some of them even died. They did not tell the public and the world that Muslim Americans were among the first to condemn 9/11 as a violation of the tenets of our faith. But that debate was hijacked. In fact, if you've seen Faisal Abdul Rauf, the imam of that initiative, he said that when the news broke out that there was a center being planned last December, it was applauded. But forward, 5 months later, it became a national debate. Why? Because some candidates wanted to exploit the issue. The same network that is viciously attacking and promoting the anti-Muslim sentiment, some of its prominent members applauded the project in December, but now it's politically more convenient to attack it because there is a midterm elections. It is more convenient to scapegoat a minority that has not a national voice or presence in politics, like the Muslim community. It's convenient and it's easy. It is more vicious and more painful, unfortunately, to exploit the legitimate fears and the wounds of the families of 9/11 and to pit them against the Muslim community in New York. That was an ugly exploitation of legitimate fear. It became an international debate, and America was tried. Can America live up to its ideals of freedom of religion? Is America only for Christians? Is America only for Jews? Or is America for everyone who believes in God? 90% of Americans believe in God. But they have different ways of looking at God. They have different ways of believing in God. And they have different ways of showing their faith in God. But we're lucky as a nation that we believe in God. And we have to promote and defend that freedom. And that's what made America, and will continue to make America, a shining beacon of hope, not only for Americans who live in it, but for people all over the world who look up to America. And they see that America lives the ideals of freedom of religion, freedom of worship, and freedom of expression. Park 51, I believe, was an important moment to define how we live our freedoms. And it was a test. Do we grant that freedom to everyone who's American? Or do we discriminate when it's convenient? From looking at it from the civil rights perspective as a national organization, I believe it was a test for our ideals and our claims to those ideals. In reading and learning about the history of the civil rights movement in the United States, about 50 years ago, there was segregation in the United States. It was promoted. It was defended. It was defended because, unfortunately, people did not speak against it. Some people were told, like today, you have the freedom to build places of worship, but don't build here. The same argument was made to African Americans. You can ride the bus, but in the back. That's how we see it. It's also a test for First Amendment. You have the right to speak, but be quiet. That's how we see it, and that's how the world sees it. But I believe, hopefully, with the passage of elections, maybe past November 5th, things will change. When the election is over, you will see that maybe our national discourse is more civil, and it's more inclusive and more responsible. But it also, it's important that the American Muslim community's role in this was very important. We acknowledge that there is fear, there's misunderstanding, and our absence from the scene is not to be excused, because extremists on both sides are exploiting that misunderstanding. I call it deadly misunderstanding. Because when we are not engaged, when we do not take control over this discourse and be responsible and promote tolerance and diversity and the beauty that God gave all of us, when we don't cherish it and promote it and defend it, the few on both sides will take full advantage of it and will get us busy in just cleaning up the mess that they create for all of us. The Muslim community in the United States has told the Muslim world and Muslims here that this is a test, like many tests in the past. There is no global or national discrimination against the Muslim community. In fact, when you examine those who are promoting Islamophobia in the United States, there are very few. There are very few. And they are the same people who are opposing the creation or expansion of Islamic centers nationwide. So I urged, for example, the organizers of the Cordoba Initiative or Park 51 to have a serious dialogue and engagement with the 9/11 families to explain to them, A, the faith of Islam, B, the position that Muslims here and all over the world have taken against 9/11 and 9/11 attackers, and C, to identify those who have stoked the anti-Muslim sentiment so that the nation and the Muslim community and the world know that these are the vocal minority. They don't represent America and they don't represent its ideals. Second, the backdrop is also the threat to burn the Quran. The threat to burn the Quran is an issue of freedom of speech. We handled that, I think, well. With our clergy in the United States, political leaders all over have condemned that act. It is legitimate, but it is dangerous. Because the ones who wanted to get like the 15 minutes of fame, they did not understand, or maybe they understood, but they wanted to ignite that conflict between Muslims and non-Muslims. Ladies and gentlemen, as a Muslim, nobody threatens my faith when they turn the Quran, when they tear it, or they burn it. They don't. But before they burn, as we said, they have to learn. They have to learn that in the Quran are the stories of Jesus, the story of Abraham, the story of Moses, the story of Jacob, the story of Noah, that the word God is mentioned almost in every page. Before they burn it, they have to remove all these references. When they do, they will end up with the two covers only. They have to understand that burning a Quran is just a physical act. But they also expose their ignorance and lack of tolerance and understanding of the Word of God, believed by Muslims and others. So I'm very proud to be an American. I'm very proud to see how responsibly our society have condemned the threat to burn the Quran. And I also would like to give credit to the Muslim community, including ourselves, who went on national and international television to tell Muslims worldwide that this act is an individual act. It's not representative of America. It's not representative of Christian values or even Christians. And I believe the first insult was not to Muslims, but to Christianity itself and Christian values. Terry Jones and his followers said, Jesus hates Muslims. Well, I'm not sure if they really ask Jesus about Muslims. So they claim to speak in the name of Christianity, and they claim to speak in the name of Christians. But I'm very happy to see that our nation has shown courage, maturity, and decisiveness on that reckless threat to burn the Quran. Ladies and gentlemen, Islamophobia, I believe, is a threat to national security. It's a threat to national security because it pits people against each other. It messes up our national security. And I'll give you examples. Racial profiling is wrong. Mistreating Muslims in airports is wrong just because they're Muslim. Stopping people just because of their appearance but not because of their actions is wrong. It may give the appearance that some people are acting in the interest of national security, but they're giving the very wrong image about the United States. After 9/11, tens of thousands of Muslims were harassed. Many of them were forced to register with immigration. And only those who belonged to certain countries were asked to do that. And many of them were put in jail until civil rights organizations stood up and questioned the wisdom and legitimacy of that act. Sending people as agent provocateurs who pretend to be convert to Islam and they have criminal record to incite and entice violence is wrong and immoral. It destroys the trust between law enforcement and an important community like the Muslim community. It reduces the level of interest and willingness to cooperate with law enforcement. Also, these news travel around the world like the speed of light. And it tells the world that America is not upholding the ideals of the protection of civil rights and equal justice for all people. Unfortunately, some people even were invited to train law enforcement on Islam. I'll give you an example. Last August, a coalition of Muslim, Sikh, and Asian American organizations, civil liberties groups, sent an open letter to the FBI director seeking an explanation of why a leader of anti-Islam organization, it's called Stop the Islamization of America, was invited to train law enforcement on the theology of Islam. Robert Spencer, co-founder of that group, was invited to talk about the belief system of the Islamic jihadist to Joint Force of Terrorism Task Force in Virginia. To the Muslim community, Robert Spencer is like David Duke, giving a seminar to law enforcement about the belief of Jews or African Americans. To bring someone, just because he's famous, to educate law enforcement about theology of other people and other minorities is dangerous. It gives the wrong impression, it destroys the trust, and it also mismanages the very precious resources of law enforcement. Also, having hundreds of thousands of people on the watch list. The watch list is a list that has many names on it, and people, because of that list, are pulled over of the lines in airports, and they are questioned about their belief, their political opinion, their religious practices, and so on. I believe the actual list does not and should not maybe include more than maybe a few hundreds. Today, that list has over 1 million entries. And let me just show you the danger of having an inflated list like that. That list has almost the majority of leaders of Muslim Americans on that list. Leaders that the government needs very much to build partnership of trust and clear communication for national security. When that list is so huge, that has hundreds of thousands, and according to the Washington Post, it topped 1 million the past year. When you add one entry, one name on it, it does not affect it. That entry was Omar Farouk Abdul Muttalib. Does that name ring a bell? Omar Farouk Abdul Muttalib is the young man who allegedly tried to detonate a bomb over Detroit last December and became a national security crisis here in the aviation industry and so on. And he was not detected. He was not seen. He went through all the security checkpoints and he made it on the flight. Do you know why? Because our national security people are overwhelmed by what? By hundreds of thousands of entries. When you add one more, it doesn't make any difference. But had we had only the actual list, when you add a name, it will trigger an alert and the resources will be deployed to spot that person, isolate him, and prevent a tragedy. But when you have a list that includes who's who in the Muslim community, it sends the wrong message. It weakens our national defense and national security. It also sends the very wrong message to the very citizens who are proud to be Americans. Just because of their faith, because of their political opinion, they should not be persecuted. They should not be punished for having different views or different political views than some. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe we can do better. Our nation has shown that it's a resilient nation and we have learned lessons from the past and we should not repeat the mistakes of the past. I believe some of the most dangerous Islamophobia aspects is the one that led us to war. When you project people as the others, when you exaggerate security threats, when you base your decisions on false or fabricated information, that's very costly. And just to be very clear, we were led to war in Iraq based on false information. What did it cost us? It cost us thousands of innocent lives on both sides. It cost us over $1 trillion. It hurt our economy. It hurt our reputation on the international level. Some of the claims were that Al-Qaeda has a base in Iraq. Al-Qaeda never had any connection or base in Iraq. But unfortunately, today Al-Qaeda has a base in Iraq. And now you have more hostility towards us as a nation in Iraq. You have a country that has been destroyed and their hopes have been dashed. And that, I believe, is a threat not only to national security, but to world security. Why? Because it was convenient and easy to stereotype people, to misinform the public. And we were absent from the action. Many of us were afraid to stand up and to question our leaders about their judgment, about their decisions. It took us years to find out that we were lied to and we were just dragged into a war that we did not need to. Ladies and gentlemen, Robert Pape is an author of two books. I'd like to mention his name. Robert Pape is the author of Dying to Win. And he's the author now of a new groundbreaking book called Cutting the Fuse. With his colleague, he got a grant from the government to examine suicide terrorism. I recommend that book to you, all of you, because in that book, Robert Pape shows that suicide terrorism is motivated by foreign occupation, not by religion. He examined suicide attacks from 1980 until 2009. He examined all of these attacks, whether in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Lebanon, Israel, Chechnya, Sri Lanka, all of these countries. And he came with that conclusion, that the root cause for suicide bombing is foreign occupation. Today, in Afghanistan, people see that there's suicide bombing happening on a frequent basis, but when Robert Pape examined, he found out that the region that has the most attacks in Afghanistan, where there are more multinational troops stationed there. And that motivates people to fight back against foreign occupation. He said in his book, this is not to justify suicide attacks, but this is to explain the root cause. So definitely the presence of militaries all over the world causes local people to resist against those occupations. Imagine if you have 30,000 troops based in Anchorage as a foreign occupation. I would expect people here to show some reaction. They should not maybe kill themselves and others, but it explains that when there is foreign occupation, people show resistance. Eventually, it is more important for us as a nation to be involved not only in domestic politics, for example, healthcare. We had fierce debate over healthcare. It passed. People still question it. We have serious debate over education, our economy, the unemployment rate. All of these are very important, and it really shows how engaged Americans are in their politics. But I believe foreign policy is equally important. I always sometimes say, and I hope I will not say it in the future, but as of now I say, foreign policy is foreign to most Americans. And we need to change that. We need to examine our foreign policy. We need to guide it. We need to make sure that it is aligned with our values, the values of compassion, the values of mercy. I would like to see, as a citizen, as a citizen of this great country, that we put more emphasis on partnership, on coexistence, and we examine the policies that led us to war and conflict. I myself strongly believe in a proposed legislation to create a new department in the U.S. government. People see it as a dream, but I think if we work on it together, we may see it happening. I hope that we Americans can push our government to legislate to create the Department of Peace. That Department of Peace will be the true reflection of America, American dreams, American values, that we put like all our resources into promoting peace and democracy around the world, that we send airplanes loaded with food, with medicine, with experts to go and help other people. Imagine the impact we'll have on human lives around the world. Imagine how people will look at the United States. Today, America still is the most admired country in the world, despite all these pitfalls. But I think to protect our prosperity and our future, we can make sure that peace is part of our global agenda. I hope to live to be part of that action, to make sure that our approach toward affairs issues is based on peace, not misunderstanding and conflict. Ladies and gentlemen, in conclusion, I would like to say that we may have come in different times to this country and on different ships, but we're all in the same boat. Thank you.
You're listening to Nihad Awad, the co-founder and executive director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. He was recorded speaking to the Alaska World Affairs Council on the rise of Islamophobia and its impact on national security in Anchorage on Friday, October 15th. Following his talk, Mr. Awad responded to questions from audience members.
Yes, thank you if you're available for a question. You discussed Islamophobia in this country. In the Islamic world, do you find a comparable amount of Christian phobia or Judeophobia Maybe if you're Palestinian, it wouldn't be quite so irrational. But can you discuss what the other world thinks of, I guess, the Islamic world thinks of the other religions, and if there's a similar amount?
There's plenty of Christian phobia in the world, and American phobia in the world. And we have to equally be concerned about that. Whenever I travel abroad, like when I'm an activist in the United States. I defend the rights of people to speak and to be equal citizens. So many people sometimes, when they misunderstand where we stand on issues, they see us as the other. They see us as the representative of the other. But once I travel abroad, I'm seen as the American representative, and I have to defend the American values. And I have to explain to people the misunderstanding that they have. But also, let me assure you that the majority of people in the Muslim world understand the other faiths and understand issues. The danger is if we allow few people here to define the relationship, and we allow the few people on the other side define the relationship, and we watch, and we are unengaged. I think we have to examine a lot of issues. Like, for example, I take comfort in the fact that Muslims not only understand Christianity, they revere Christianity. Muslims not only understand Judaism, they revere Judaism. Why? Because it's part of our faith. To believe in Abraham, to believe in Jesus, to believe in Moses. In fact, you're not a Muslim if you don't believe in any of these prophets. So the understanding of faith is there. But also, there are violations of those understanding. There are people who do not comply with their faith. We have plenty of extremists who, for political reasons or because of lack of their sophistication, they try to hijack that relationship and try to maybe commit violence against people. But in my judgment as a Muslim, that is despite Islam, not because of Islam. And we have to promote the voices of tolerance, the voices of reason. And we need to build partnership with these people. So I would say Islamophobia, anti-Christians or Judaism or anti-Western is a twin phenomenon. You will not win against one unless you win against the other. So it's a mutual responsibility to fight against misunderstanding. And I believe ignorance lies at the heart of this issue. It is known that people fear what they don't know. When they know each other, they will become more tolerant, more understanding, more appreciative, and they will focus on more common values. And that does not take them away from the right to disagree over things. But disagreement does not always mean conflict.
I'm just a guest, so thank you very much for allowing me to come. And so I really appreciate getting to ask a question. Do you know or do you have an opinion, based on everything you've said in your background, on considering how things are going and the different opinions around the world, why did the United States, if I'm correct, just sell $60 billion of military weaponry to Saudi Arabia? And what impact would that kind of action have on the world?
I wish I was a military expert to answer this question to your satisfaction, but unfortunately, as I said, conflict and tension is a thriving industry. As I said just moments ago, the industry of death seems to be profitable. And I think the challenge for me and all of us is to nurture the climate and the culture of life and reduce not only the sale, but the use of arms and weapons of mass destruction, and not allow the mass media and the media that unfortunately continues to misrepresent the facts or misplace the facts in the minds of people to widen the gap between nations. I know that, for example, in the Middle East, there's a growing tension. There's like polarization. There's Iran is being seen as threat to Israel and the United States and to some neighboring countries, but also those countries feel threatened also by each other and by Israel, and that cycle is very vicious. I'm sure some people are profiting from arms sales. It might be good for short term. I'm opposed to the use of weapons of mass destruction. A, because it is against my faith, because in my faith we celebrate and honor the sanctity of human life. And weapons of mass destruction is a collective punishment. No matter how surgical you want to be, you always kill innocent people, and the killing of innocent people is never justified under any circumstance. So on a moral line, I will say, I'm totally opposed to the use of weapons of mass destruction, let alone marketing them, promoting them, and justifying them.
Thank you. I found it interesting that you didn't name the network, in quotes, Fox. I'll say it. Many of us call it faux news. And I was just wondering why you don't condemn or come out more condemning, you know, the right ilk, such as, you know, Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, Sarah Palin, and her Tea Party members, and condemn their ignorance. Thank you.
Well, maybe you're trying to read my mind. I just want to focus on the issue itself, without naming people or blaming specific individuals, because these people and this network, I think, are taking advantage of our silence. We let some of these networks and these individuals have a free ride to misrepresent the facts and to provide a comfort zone for themselves and their likes to unfortunately project us as the other, as a threat to American values and so on. And I think they need to be challenged. But I wanted also to say that last Saturday, I announced at our national conference in Washington, D.C., that we're launching a new department within our organization to monitor Islamophobia. And we're going to come up with an annual report tracking, monitoring these Islamophobes and their statements and their actions, and just provide that information to the public, to our community, policymakers, and even other commentators. I think we just have to fight back, because if we let this go, it will be dangerous to all of us. And you know, we'll just wake up one day and see that, you know, hatred and intolerance is the norm, and it will be too late for us just to catch up. So I believe we have to stand up right now. We have to speak up, not only in favor of our interests, but we have really to come to the defense of all people who need our voices now, because we may need their voices later. And I think it is just morally right to speak up the truth and stand against phobia, any kind of phobia, and organize, build coalitions, and send a very good and important message, not only to the victims of discrimination and Islamophobia, but to our children. To our children who are going to grow up, and they have to see that their parents, their elderly, have done their job to fight back, and they have taken stands when they could.
Good afternoon. I'm a professor at APU, and my students are planning to become teachers. And we teach about the Constitution in fourth grade. And I think we all need to revisit the First Amendment, because with every right that we have, we also have responsibilities. And in the First Amendment, it says, yes, we have the right to express what we believe, but we have to do it in a peaceful manner. It specifically says a peaceful manner. It's the reason why we have a court system. And in the court, to burn someone's property is considered a crime. It's called arson, and it's treated with the same court system as we also treat people who are considered have murdered someone. It's considered on the same level as murdering. And so the act of burning a Quran is really not free speech. It's a misinterpretation of our First Amendment. And I really resent the fact that we allowed our journalists to say this on television, which went around the world. So now the rest of the world feels that the act of burning a Quran or whatever is the same as free speech. It is not. So the question, my point actually is not a question, as you can see, but I do want you to be aware that we have misinterpreted the Constitution and calling the act of, or the thought of burning the Quran is not supported in the First Amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe it's part of free speech to have the ability to interpret free speech. So, in a peaceful manner.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
My name is Raba Chetfor. I'm from Algeria, and I've been a resident of Alaska for many years. My question to you, to what you said earlier, there are about 2,000 mosques in the U.S., in the United States of America. There are barely 500 imams. In order to help with your quest to teach people, we need scholars. And what are you doing about getting us some scholars, either in this country or bringing them some that you vet and basically, you know, agree, you know, basically they go through the process of teaching in here? Because our biggest enemy is ignorance. And when you have people that cannot explain it, it's hard for us to explain what it is, you know, to get this Islamophobia out of, you know, clearing, you know, resolved, in other words. So what is being done by CARE and other Islamic, institutions to bring more scholars or to teach, you know, more people to get that podium in there.
Okay, thank you. I started to see the growth of Islamic institutions and colleges that train American imams, like Zaytuna College. It just recently opened in California. And I have seen similar efforts now nationwide, including a university that was created some time ago, but now it's been reactivated in Chicago. An organization like ours, which is concerned with advocacy, we do also training. For example, this past weekend, we had our National Leadership Conference. We trained people in communication skills, public speaking, on-camera interviews, explaining the law and politics so that they're all familiar. But also, we need more in-depth institutions, like to give college degrees and have seminaries where people are qualified and also they're familiar with the culture, with the politics, with the history of both America and the Muslim world. So I think we're getting into that slowly but surely. That's part of the challenge, to negotiate our presence in a peaceful way and make sure that there's due process, there's interaction, that trust is built on mutual interest, mutual understanding, the government has a vested interest in keeping the legal people here and limiting the presence of people who are illegal and do not fit. So that's I believe a policy issue, security issue, but I think there is more now conversation between the government and Muslim community organizations. It's a challenge, we're dealing with it, and we're coming up, in fact, with some detailed reports that we're going to present to Congress and to the government to dissect this phenomenon and deal with it efficiently.
Would you please recommend to this group a starting place to learn about Islam? Would you recommend them reading the Quran? Would you recommend a summary otherwise?
I appreciate this question. In fact, it is one of the main points that I would like people to keep in mind is part of the solution is education, and education is to get the right information from authentic sources, authentic Islamic sources. Unfortunately, I'm going to get your question right away. Before 9/11, I used to go and visit public libraries just to look at the books. I'm just curious to see how Islam is being presented. And I would say probably 70% to 30% rate, 70% of the books are anti-Islam, misrepresenting Islam, and maybe 30% are books written by either by Muslims or by objective authors. Today, it's like almost 90% anti-Islam and 10% are objective. So it's very challenging to go or walk into like a public library or bookstore and find authentic sources about Islam. What I would recommend is visit, for example, islam.org and look at the writings of people like John Esposito. I'm sure maybe some of you are familiar with his writings. Our website, Sayyid Hussein Nasr, NASR. Our website provides a group of, books that we have made available to public libraries nationwide after 9/11. And definitely the Quran itself. There's a lot of debate and national discourse about the Quran. I think it's important. I know that Americans, like many Westerners, read a lot. And by the way, the first word that was revealed in the Quran was read. Read. So reading is very important. And I think reading the Quran is very, very important. Make yourself familiar with the Quran. I recommend the translation of Muhammad Asad. Muhammad Asad. Asad is A-S-A-D. He was a European Muslim. Understands the Judeo-Christian culture. So when he interprets the verses, he takes into account the terminology, theology, and I think he did an excellent job in presenting the translation of the Quran to the world. In fact, it is a copy of the Quran that we endorsed at CARE, and we make it available to intellectuals, public officials, and so on. So if you would like, and again, I'm not proselytizing here, but if you would like, contact us, and we will make copies available to you of the Quran if you need, or other books.
We are happy to have you here, Mr. Awad. My question, actually, I just have to make a comment. Actually, at Alaska Pacific University, through Gina and Mary Margaret, we have done a wonderful job with Engaging Muslims program, which is this money was donated by Larry Carswart. We are very, actually, thankful to him for this donation. And most of the questions, which is we have, whatever the best of ability to answer them, is about the human rights for both males and females. But most of the questions is the respect of women in our religion. Can you please elaborate on that?
I think you should get a woman to answer this question. Because I'm tired of talking about women, and women are not present to express themselves. The simple answer I used to give is, ask my mother. She has been the boss, you know, in our home. Or ask my wife, you know. I think people will be pleasantly surprised to see the position of women in Islam. Ask Muslim ladies, don't ask Muslim men. Ask if they are oppressed, and they'll tell you. You're just, you know, asking Muslim men about Muslim women is doesn't get you maybe the right answer. You know, Islam gave the freedom for women to be themselves, independent, in fact, men and women are equal in the eyes of God in the Quran. If some Muslims defy that, it is despite Islam, not because of it. If you see some cultural practices that are anti-women, it is because of their culture, not because of their faith. In Islam, I'm honored to be a Muslim because of so many things, because of the concept of equality and freedom. Women and men are equal in the eyes of God in Islam. They're independent. They own business. The Prophet, peace be upon him, himself, used to work for his wife. His wife used to be a powerful businesswoman. And the first person in Islam who converted to Islam, accepted Islam, was woman. The first martyr in Islam was woman. And Islam gave the right to woman to vote 1400 years ago. There were Muslim women leaders, intellectuals. That's the position of the Muslim woman in Islam. I'm sure there is more detail. The dress is not a sign of oppression. It's a sign of modesty for both men and women. They're obligated to dress modestly. The position and roles of men and women are defined, but they are partners. I mean, for example, in Islam, there's big emphasis on family. But also, the responsibilities are divided equally. I mean, you should be in my home and see when my wife and I talk about responsibilities at home. You know, I cannot ask her to do anything at home. Because she said, you should do it, and I do it. No, I mean, being a husband and wife is a partnership, true equal partnership. Each one plays a different role because of who they are, because of their abilities. But there should be no discrimination. No one is above the other because of, you know, their nature. In Islam, both are equal in the eyes of God. And that's the Quran. I always go to the Quran. People can give me their outlooks, their interpretations, their views. They're entitled to it. But I'm judged by the values and teachings of the Quran. The ayat, the verses that address the issue of women and men are unequivocal. They cannot be misinterpreted. For example, similar to the issues of the sanctity of human life. I know it's outside the subject, but it is, my point is, verses when it comes to critical issues cannot be misunderstood. If people would like to misapply them, it's because of them. But the clarity of the verses cannot be misunderstood. For example, three issues and I'll conclude. The sanctity of human life. The one who takes an innocent life is as if he or she takes the lives of the entire humankind. And the saving of an innocent life is equivalent to the saving of the entire mankind. On freedom of religion, let there be no compulsion in religion. If anybody is forced to believe or act contrary to their desire or their decision, that's coercion. That's in violation of the faith. So the matter is very clear. Sometimes you see societies, you see governments intolerant towards people, towards freedoms, they act in defiance and in violation of Islam, not because of it.
Thank you for coming. America is a big tent and it has room for Christians, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, atheists and agnostics, so I applaud your efforts to increase the size of that tent. I think how you're characterizing Islamophobia, there may be a disconnect. I think most Americans are really more fearful of radical Islam, not mainstream Islam, and that we have a difficult time differentiating between those two. So there are victims of mainstream Muslim, a moderate Muslim community within America, who are in effect victims through racial profiling or whatever because of the fear that Americans have towards the threat of radical Islam. Our military is engaged in it. So my question to you, I really have two questions. Do you think if the Muslim American community or the moderate American community would be more forceful and more upfront in helping to fight their cousins, the radical Islamists, do you think that would better serve your interests in terms of diminishing the fear that Americans might have and then being able to differentiate between, in effect, those two divergent factions? And then I also want to make a comment. You know, our American Constitution says all men, women are created equal, but it really didn't happen until 1954 with Brown versus Topeka Board of Education. The Quran may say that men and women are equal, but in countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran and Pakistan and Afghanistan, women don't have the same opportunities for education, opportunity, even a drive and so forth. How do you kind of traverse that kind of dialogue in your discussion, please?
Two questions that need two lectures. Okay, but I'll be quick. On the first one, to me, I don't see moderate or non-moderate. I see Islam and Muslims as mainstream. There's an exception to that. And unfortunately, for example, in the United States, in the West, there's a comfort just to do it not the easy way, the lazy way. Just to project what comes on the TV screen and surrender or reduce the entire experience of the 1.6 billion Muslims all over the world to just to the headline news. And I think that will be unfair. And sometimes I say the not only the lazy way, but also the convenient way. I'll give you an example. On 9/11, that was, of course, a horrible day that none of us will ever forget. And I knew on that day how difficult our job has been and will be because of that attack, because of the misconception about Islam. Within hours of the attack, my organization managed to get a statement of condemnation signed by the major 8 national organizations within hours to condemn the attack clearly and decisively. We sent that condemnation to 45,000 media outlets nationwide. How many outlets, radio, television, newspapers, have elected to show the position of the Muslim organizations on 9/11? How many? Zero. And years after that, we will be asked, whether on Fox, your favorite station, or others, where are the moderate Muslims? Have you condemned 9/11? Have you condemned terrorism? And we say, we did. But maybe you did not hear us. Maybe you chose not to show that that was our position. In fact, Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square's would-be bomber, when he was arrested, we condemned him and we asked for full extent of the law to be applied against him. Did that make the news? No. When he was convicted, just about a couple of weeks ago, we issued a statement congratulating our government for taking that measure. And I have the story here. Washington Post. Where did it go? Here. A3, almost three quarters of a page. Did our statement make it? You guessed it. It did not. So we speak. In fact, on 9/11, we purchased a full page ad in the Washington Post. We paid to put an ad offering condolences, condemning the attackers, and thanking the rescue team for what they have done. Where we paid money to make sure that people know where American Muslims stand on this issue. We did the petition online. We asked people nationwide to express themselves, and we compiled 68 pages of condemnation of 9/11. We did PSAs in Arabic, English, and Urdu. Many of these efforts are not shown. You know why? Because in the media, if it, what does it say? If it bleeds, it leads. If it bleeds, it leads. Our statements did not bleed, and they did not lead. So that doesn't mean that there are people who are trying to murky the water on both sides. If you look at the experience of the 1.6 billion Muslims and 8 million American Muslims, you will be very comforted to know that these are your brothers and sisters in humanity. They lead good and peaceful life. But unfortunately, we have been just only reduced to what we see on television, the violent actions. It's exactly like judging Christianity in America by the actions of Timothy McVeigh or Eric Rudolph, the one who commits bombings against abortion clinics in the name of Christianity. In the name of Christianity. He believes that the Bible, that God asked him to kill abortion doctors because he believes in life. We all know that this is in defiance of Christianity. Why? Because we know what Christianity stands for. But when it comes to Islam, it's more difficult. It's more difficult to get that conclusion. The second question was about the disparity between the belief and the practice in the Muslim world. As I said, unfortunately, cultural practices are taking place, and they are in defiance of my faith, whether they are done by governments or it's the norm in some cultures. Women have the right to drive and to be pioneers, to be educated, and to be independent. If some societies deprive them from that, it's their misfortune. But we make it very clear when we travel, when we write, when we speak, we always make that known, that this is in defiance of our faith. It's not in response to our faith. So we all have to work together just to make sure that our faiths are practiced, at least by our persons, and when we see a deviation, that will be seen. I mean, I always tell my brothers and sisters in the Muslim community, instead of condemning this and that, and just pointing out to the crooked lines, we ourselves, through our behavior, we draw the straight line, and the crooked line will stand out.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Nihad Awad, who is the co-founder and executive director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Following his talk entitled The Rise of Islamophobia and Its Impact on National Security, Mr. Awad responded to questions from audience members. The complete question and answer session is posted on our website at kska.org. under Addressing Alaskans. The Alaska World Affairs Council played host to Nihad Awad in Anchorage on October 15th, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.